It's Wednesday, July 19th. This is the Christian Commute. This is your host, Seth Dunn. You're riding home with me on a blistering hot Georgia afternoon. I guess it could be the evening. I don't want to say blistering hot evening because that doesn't make sense. But it is 5:27. Thanks for joining me on what looks to be the last Christian Commute of the week. I have vacation days scheduled tomorrow and Friday, so I will not be commuting. As you can hear in my voice, I'm feeling a little better. Well, I jinxed myself. I said I was feeling better, then I had to cough. I'm feeling a little better than I have the last couple days. So I'm trying to get back in the swing of things. I hope I can fully beat this illness before tomorrow when I'm supposed to take my Hebrew final. And so I'll have to go anywhere. It's an online final. I'll take it in my house. But don't want to be all sniffly. And then Friday, I want to go to the zoo or something, so I definitely want to feel better, so have a little bit of a summer vacation. My summer vacation this summer was Hebrew, and it was terrible. But I learned Hebrew. No, I didn't. I learned things that Hebrew means. I learned how Hebrew's supposed to be. How about that? We'll say that. But I'm all the better for it, I suppose. And thanks for tuning in to the last Christian Commute of the week. I have a full show today. I have a question in the inbox about parables. Today's show topic is called Kings and Pawns. Kings and Pawns. But before we get to that, we will continue in our Bible chapter review. And I'm going to try to go the whole way today. I feel better, as you can tell, but my voice may give out. I am still sick. 2 Corinthians 12, verses 14 through 15. Yesterday, I failed to mention the verse. I think I listened to the show yesterday, and I didn't say what verses that I was in. Yesterday, I think I did 12 and 13. So here we find Paul continuing his talk with the Corinthians in verse 14, and he tells them, I dropped my cough drop. What else could go wrong? And he tells them that he's ready to visit them for a third time. So here in 2 Corinthians, Paul is telling the Corinthians that he's ready to visit them for a third time. He's already been there and addressed some problems that they have. And he's already been there initially to plant the church. The Corinthian church was started by Paul. And we know that from his earlier words in the Corinthian epistles. And he says he has no plans to burden them financially. You'll recall from yesterday that Paul was letting them know that he made a point not to burden them financially, even though he could have demanded support as an apostle, but he said he didn't. So he says, I come to visit you again, or I plan to come and visit you for a third time. I have no plans to burden you financially. He says, I don't seek what is yours. I seek you. I do not seek what is yours, I seek you. In other words, he's not seeking their financial or material support. He's seeking them. He wants their souls. Not for himself, of course, but for Christ's service. And he makes a comparison between parents and children. He says, I'll gladly expend myself. And I'll gladly spend and expend myself for your sake. Like parents do for children. And Paul says, you know, children don't think, hey, let's save up so we can support our parents. No, it's the other way around. Parents worry about how they're going to support their children. And don't get confused here, because we know even in the old culture here, especially in this ancient culture, because they didn't have social security and nursing homes, people's offspring took care of them when they got older. It's like I remember when my grandparents got to be in their 90s, they couldn't go out. They couldn't drive themselves to the grocery store or whatever, or drive themselves to their doctor's appointment. So my dad would take them to the doctor's appointment or take them to the grocery store or whatever, looking after them. That happens a lot of times where your parents get old and they'll either move very close to you or they'll move in with you. And you take care of them as they become infirm. You take care of the elderly. That's not what Paul's talking about here. When he talks about children, he's talking about little children, like the children my age, like my little four-year-old children. They're not worried about, well, how are we going to help Dad get by? They're kids. They don't worry about stuff like that. But their mother and I, we're like, well, how are we going to save for their education? Or how are we going to pay for their preschool? Or, you know, how do we need to get them clothes? We're working hard for them. We're giving what we earn to them. We're expending ourselves to raise them up. And you think about the Corinthian church like Paul's spiritual children, because Paul planted the church. So he's not there to make an income off of them, or to, what's the word I'm looking for? Lounge off them? That's not the word. Sponge off them? Yes, sponge off them. Paul's not looking to sponge off them. You know, to get a paycheck as an apostle. No, he's looking to pour himself into the Corinthian church, whether they like it or not. Just as parents pour themselves into the lives and welfare of their children, financially and spiritually, whether the kids like it or not. He's looking out for them like a parent. And parents, those of you who are parents, you'll gladly do it. My parents love me. I know they've spent thousands of dollars on me. They don't ever make me feel like guilty. You know, we spent a lot of money on you. I just feel loved by my parents. So when you have children, you expend yourself on them. But you don't say, you don't make them feel like this is what I'm doing for you. You just love on them and raise them up. So Paul has that love for the Corinthian church. That's what he means when he doesn't seek what is theirs, he seeks them. He really wants to give to them and pour in to them. And Paul asks, almost rhetorically, if I love more, should I be loved less? He's basically saying, you guys, I'm loving you so much. I'm loving you to the point that I don't want to burden you financially. But it's almost like you're holding it against me, like I'm not worth it because I don't want to. Maybe the super apostles come to you and expect all this support, and you think, well, that's what we're paying for it, so it must be worth something. People have an idea that unless they're paying for something, it's not worth anything. I've told this story before, and I'll give this example again about the resource table at my former church. There are books and tracts sitting there. It's free, take one. Nobody ever took one. And then the pastor put, you know, $5. And I said, why is this $5 now? He says, because people will take it if they think it's worth $5. If it's free, they won't think it's worth anything. So that's how people tend to think. So Paul is, you know, the Corinthians are comparing Paul to the rhetoricians who command this giant speaking fee. And Paul's coming in there and just serving them and not expecting anything. Should he be loved less because he's not charging them? You gotta ask yourself if you want to think this. How much does your dad charge you for breakfast? You know, when you're a little kid. When I sit my kids down in the morning and give them Cheerios and orange juice, I'm not like, all right, that'll be $3. They don't have anything to give. That's how parents love their children. They don't charge them for it. And Paul's loving his Corinthian children that way. He's not charging them for it. And get the idea of children. Little children. Not just offspring in general. Like, I'm 35, my brother is 46. We're my dad's children, we're his offspring, but we're also grown adults. We can take care of ourselves. Paul's talking about the Corinthians like, y'all are children. Children. I'm taking care of you. So, look at it that way. And we'll leave the Bible chapter of you right there. And we'll move on to the inbox, SethDunn88@gmail.com. That is the Christian Commute inbox, SethDunn88@gmail.com. If you need theological roadside assistance, write in. Send me your question about apologetics or theology. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter @GSethDunn and like the Christian Commute Facebook page. And this is the last open question that I have in the inbox. So if you guys want to send some stuff in Thursday and Friday so I can start Monday's show with a question, That'd be great. This question comes from Michael in Arizona, who's another frequent submitter. He's catching up with Nikki and Elsie in Pennsylvania on the top submitter stats. And he writes a rather long email, but to make it short and sweet, he asked, do parables apply to everybody today? Jesus' parables from the Gospels. Do they just apply to the Jews that Jesus is giving them to, or telling them to, or do they apply to everybody? Do they apply to Christians? Do they apply to the world? because when preachers preach out of these parables today, a lot of times they're going to apply them to the lives of the Christians in their congregations. And Michael's wondering if this is appropriate. Now, I get the feeling that Michael's reading New Perspective literature, Kingdom Now literature from somebody like N.T. Wright, who's stressing the Jewish context of the Gospels and the New Testament. That's the popular thing lately. For the New Perspective people like N.T. Wright to come along and say, well, you got the reformers like Luther and Calvin. They read the Bibles, but they read them in the mindset of 16th century people and how their legal system worked and their version of law. But when we think about the law from the New Testament context, we need to think about Jewish law. Let's look at this in the Jewish context. And that seems commonsensical. We do want to look at things from a Jewish context, but oftentimes the New Perspective Kingdom Now people can go a little too far. So that's the way Michael reads his emails. And Michael, you can correct me if I'm wrong. It seems like you're getting some influence from the N.T. Wright Kingdom Now crowd. But let's get back to the meat of his question before I go on that rabbit trail. And people write in for like this simple question. I'm like, well, let me talk about the New Perspective on Paul and the history of hermeneutics. okay, parables. So your general question, Michael, is do these parables apply to everybody, or do they just apply to the Jews that he's speaking to? Are there pastors twisting these parables? Yes, there are preachers who twist the parables. But the answer is it depends. That's the answer to a lot of things, isn't it? It depends. You have to take this parable by parable. So here's an example of a parable that relates specifically to the Jews in the context of the time of Christ. And it doesn't really have much of an application to the church today other than to realize who we are. Let's consider the parable of the wicked tenants. Okay, the parable of the wicked tenants. So Jesus tells the crowd the parable. And the crowd is Jewish leaders, like especially scribes and Pharisees. Oftentimes, you know, the people who are getting condemned in these parables are the immediate audience. So Jesus is telling a story. And he says, here's a parable. There was a certain landowner who had a vineyard, and he rented it out to tenants. And when it came time for the landlord to collect the rent, which would be after the tenants grow the grapes and turn them into wine or olive oil, if it was olives, I mean, whatever, it doesn't kind of matter what kind of vineyard it is. It's almost like sharecropping, if you will. So the tenants owe the landlord his portion. He owned the land, but they did the work. So they get a cut, but the landlord gets his cut. So he sends his servant to the tenants to collect payment. But they beat his servant, send him away empty-handed. So he sends another servant. Well, they kill that servant and don't pay the rent. So the landlord finally says, I'll send my son, not just a servant. Surely they'll respect my son. So here comes the son coming to try and collect the rent. And the wicked tenants see the son and say, now he sent his son. Let's kill the son, and then there'll be no one to inherit the property, and we'll kill him and take his inheritance. So they do that. And Jesus asks the crowd, he goes, what's the landlord going to do to those wicked tenants? Now, who's that parable about? It's about the Jews. So God the Father has entrusted them with the promised land, with the law, with the message of redemption for the people. But what have the Jews done but fallen into syncretism, disobeyed God, been hard-hearted. They're under Roman subjugation. They were under Persian subjugation. They were under Babylonian subjugation. They broke up and the northern kingdom got under Assyrian subjugation. They've been enslaved and destroyed because they were given the promise, they were given the land, and they didn't keep their part of the covenant. And when God would send a prophet, they would reject the prophet. So we see this pattern of people like Elijah or Isaiah or Jeremiah or whomever getting rejected. They pronounce a Jeremiad. That's where that word comes from. They're saying, you know, repent, turn back, and the prophet gets rejected by the people. That's the servant in the parable getting rejected by the Jews. So the landowner sends his son. That's God the Father sending Jesus Christ. And the Jews reject him. What's the landowner going to do? He's going to kick out the wicked tenants and give the land to people who will respect him and pay the rent. Now who's that? That's the church. He's going to kick out the false Israel and put in the true Israel of God. And the Jews, I think in this particular case, a lot of times they don't understand parables, but I think if my memory serves, this time they get it. So what Jesus is talking about here is replacing the Jewish leadership with his own spiritual leadership who respects him. So now the promised land is going to all God's people, Jew and Gentile alike. And the wicked tenants who rejected God's plan, rejected God's prophets, and rejected God's sons are being taken out of power. How do we apply this today? Well, we look at that tract of land over there in the Middle East, Israel, and say, that doesn't belong to the Jews, to the Jewish, ethnically Jewish people, through a covenant promise. It belongs to the church, God's people. And the real promised land is not this little piece of land right here. It's the new Jerusalem that's coming. It's the heavenly city. That's how we would apply that. So as a modern-day Christian, how do I go home and apply this? Well, I need to make sure I pay my rent on time. No, that's not what it's about. You know, the preacher can't say, how many of you aren't paying your rent on time? How many of you aren't giving people honor where it's due? Or you're not paying your taxes where it's due. You need to do it. Be the right thing. No, that's a parable about historical things that happened. Jews rejecting God and being replaced by the church. This is where the term replacement theology comes from. That's what that parable means. And it absolutely, Michael, applies to the Jewish people and the Jewish time. But what about other parables? Could they apply to people now? Well, what about parables about the second coming or parables about the resurrection? What about the parable of the virgins? Well, that applies to people now, because that's talking about the second coming, and that's what we're waiting on now. So you have to go parable by parable to see, is this something with continuing application into the future, or is this something that's describing a point in history? Because the parable about the wicked tenants describes a point of history. God is replacing the wicked tenants. They've been replaced and are replaced in perpetuity, the end. So it was to the unfaithful Jews. And we as the faithful church, we recognize and apply that. But there's not really a point of sermon application other than, you know, stop being a John Hagee Israel zealot, if that's what you are. But what's very helpful to us is that the parables are often explained. So Jesus will tell a parable, the people won't get it, and then he'll explain it to the disciples. And it says this is to fulfill the prophecy that they'll be hearing but not understanding. So to answer your question, Michael, some parables can only apply to the Jews at the time. I just gave you one. But some can be applicable to Christian life today. And you take Jesus' teaching parable by parable, and he explains them for you most of the time in the text. Not too hard. And even the ones that are explained in the text and apply to Christians today still, that doesn't mean some preacher's not going to get a hold of them and twist them in some way to make some cute point, some modern point that
you know, you can make a modern point out of a parable. You can make a modern point the wrong way. So they can be, number one, mishandled outside of their historical setting, like you point out, Michael, and they can, number two, be mishandled just outside of their general setting going into the future. So I hope that helps. Thanks for writing in. Michael sends in some interesting stuff sometimes. Keep those good questions coming, guys, to the Christian Commute inbox. Now let's talk about today's show topic, kings and pawns. I was thinking about how you treat lost people in general, how you treat deceived people, or how you treat wolves. And I got to thinking of this for because I was looking at Twitter. I was looking at Twitter last Sunday. I was home. My kids were sick before I got sick, so we didn't get to go to church Sunday. So Sunday morning, I was sitting at home with sick kids. I was on the phone looking at Twitter, and I saw a pastor from town, Brother Morton from First Baptist, had tweeted out that he went to church in Decatur. So I guess he had the day off at his church. And he went to this big church in Decatur, House of Hope, or something like that. The big, big, for lack of a better description, black church in Decatur. And like all evangelical muckety-mucks do, pastors, seminary professors, they can't meet with some other pastor and not tweet their picture out with him and say, so glad to have had fellowship with other big-time pastors. Big time pastor number one's Twitter account says, was blessed to meet with big time pastor number two today at big time pastor number two church tweet. That's how they do. So I'm looking at that and I'm like, who is this guy that my brother Morton's with? Because I look at the name of his church, House of Hope. Whenever I see a church with some name that's anything other than place, denomination, church, it makes me not worry, but it makes me suspect of them. Here's an example. I go to Roland Springs Place Baptist denomination church. You look at our church name, you can be pretty sure what kind of doctrine we preach and what our culture is. Just like Brother Morton is at First Baptist Church of Cartersville, denomination, place. Cartersville, place, First Presbyterian denomination, church. But when churches start like the Potter's House, this is the Potter's House. Well, that's T.D. Jakes' modalist church. Elevation Church. Oh, yeah, you're high, you're Elevation. Oh, that's Stephen Furtick's church. New Spring. Oh, wow, it's a New Spring. Oh, that's Perry Noble's church. So it's rare that you find a church with one of these prosperity hucksters or Bible twisters or narcissists that is place, denomination, church. So curiosity gets the best of me. I start, you know, who is Pastor so-and-so on Brother Morton's Twitter? And he is the pastor of House of Hope Church, and he is one of the stars on The Preachers. Now, this is a show on Fox. It's like The View, except of a bunch of ladies, it's a bunch of black preachers. Now, you white folks who are listening be like, I don't understand. Why would somebody watch a show that's a panel full of preachers? The black culture and the white culture are different when it comes to church. Like, in black culture, the preacher is not just the pastor. He's like a media mogul. So he needs, you know, he's driving a Bentley, he's producing movies, you know, I'm not saying this guy from Decatur drives a Bentley, but he's driving a Bentley, he's got the nicest suits, he knows the celebrities, it's almost like a celebrity. In fact, they call the wife of the preacher the first lady. She gets gifts from the church, you know, her own parking space. So a preacher in the black church is like a megastar. You got to understand that. And the bigger the church, the bigger the megastar he is. So it's totally not unusual to have a show called The Preachers to have black preachers giving their opinion on pop culture and current events. So I look at who's on this show. And one of the guys on this show, I want to say his name's John Gray. He is an associate pastor at Lakewood Church. Now, that's Joel Osteen's church. That's a place, but it doesn't have a denomination. Lakewood Church. And I'm like, wow, this guy that Brother Morton is down here hobnobbing with has a TV show that just seems awfully worldly with this guy from this apostate church, this false teaching church, Lakewood. If I was a pastor, I would never have a TV show where I partner with somebody from Joel Osteen's church. What fellowship does light have with darkness? Now, I might have a TV show where I debate him and I say, you're wrong about this, and he says, you're wrong about this. But I wouldn't have a show where it's called The Preachers and like, this guy's a preacher like I am, or like this other guy is. Like, if you're a preacher, you don't want to hang out with false teachers. So I look at this and I'm like, Brother Morton, isn't this the guy who has that show with the Joel Osteen dude? And I think to myself, I don't know this guy from Adam. And Jeremy Morton does. So maybe Brother Morton's down there and he's telling the guy, like, hey, since I'm friends with you and we're both pastors, now since I've been nice to you and I've got your ear, maybe you want to rethink this really worldly looking show with this guy from Lakewood. And I think, is that a better approach than I would have, which is basically, I would go after this guy. Now, I didn't go after this guy, I didn't feel like it, but you find somebody like John Gray or John Gray's partner on the Preachers, and I'd be like, Wolf, run. You know, there's something wrong with this guy. And I think, well, what's the difference? Is this person lost? Is this person a false teacher? How do I approach this person? What method is better? Now, I'm not saying that that's what Jeremy was down there doing. I'm just trying to think through it. You know, a lot of times we see a famous pastor who we think is sound, or a prominent pastor, maybe not famous, who we think is sound, and they're with some huckster. Like when you see John Piper preaching with Beth Moore or Christine Kane, we think, what are you doing? And maybe they're making friends with them, getting their ear, and saying, hey, here's some matters you need correction on. I'm coming and trying to help them. Rather than just, you know, immediately dropping the bomb and going after them. And I got to thinking, I said, what's the right approach? And then the thing that came to my head was kings and pawns. Kings and pawns. You know, I had a show a while back. It was called Have Mercy on the Marks. There's a difference in how you would approach Joel Osteen and how you approach the people that are at his church being deceived by Joel Osteen. So let me break it down for you this way. The people at Joel Osteen's church, or Elevation Church, or New Spring Church, or the Venue Church in Chattanooga, they are the deceived, by and large. But the pastor, scare quotes, is the deceiver. So when you walk into a field of sheep and there's sheep getting devoured by wolves, you don't walk up to the sheep and say, you stupid sheep, what's wrong with you? You're getting eaten by these wolves. No, you smack the wolf in the head. You don't beat the sheep, you beat the wolf. You know? The lion or the tiger or the bear, you slay whatever is attacking the sheep. Now, in these big word of faith megachurches, some of the people just want to have their ear tickled, and they're just as demonic as the false teacher up there. But you can be sure that the guy who's running the show knows exactly what he's doing. And you look at a chessboard, and you look at kings and pawns. There's what? There's 10 pawns on a chessboard. There's one king. All right? And when you play chess, often you'll sacrifice the pawns to get a position. That happens in battle too. When you're on the battlefield and there's a general and a bunch of foot soldiers, the general says charge and the foot soldiers charge. They get shot. The general stays in back and commands. If the general dies if the general dies, the whole army's going to be in disarray. In fact, that's what, you know, like guerrilla fighters would do in colonial times. Think of the type of warfare, say continental warfare, I think what you called it. And this is before World War I. So you talk like Civil War times, Revolutionary War times, French and Indian War times. When you have a battlefield, one army would march out, another army would march out, they'd face each other, and then they'd fight, almost like a boxing match. And the more guerrilla types in this type of warfare, they would intentionally target the officers. Because they'd have a lieutenant on a horseback, and he'd say, you know, first line, kneel, second line, stand, take aim, first line, fire, second line, fire, first line, fire. And he would tell them, he would execute the musket volleys. You shoot here, now you shoot. Now you guys stand up, move 10 feet forward, get down, shoot, and he's managing it. And all of these foot soldiers in this horrible war, they've got this battle, they've got explosions and the chaos of war going around them, but they've been trained to listen to the voice of that lieutenant. Listen to your sergeant, listen to your lieutenant, listen to your captain, and they're going through in a very orderly way. Well, if you pick off the lieutenant, well, they won't know what to do. And that could be a guerrilla tactic. It'd be considered uncouth to do that, or ungentlemanly, or it's not fighting the war with honor, but you pick off the people. And think about it in chess. You don't win a game of chess by taking pawns. In the game of chess, you can take all 10 pawns and still lose if they take your king before you take theirs. So the way that you deal with a pawn, the pawn of a deceiver, I think is going to be inherently different than the way you deal with that king. Right? Kings and pawns. So I don't know if House of Hope Church is an unsound church. I've never been there. I've never listened to their sermons. All I know that the pastor there is a media mogul with a flashy website who hangs out with a guy from Joel Osteen's church on a Fox TV show. Doesn't look good for him. But he's had 1,000 people in his church. So you never want to go after an individual deceived sheep and say, this person goes to this church. They're terrible for going to this church. No, you go to that person and you start asking them questions. You know, why do you go to that church? What do you believe about that church? Well, what do you believe about the Bible? Do you think this lines up with the Bible? And you try to pick them up. Now, that's the pawn. They're only a pawn in their game. What's that Bob Dylan song? It's about Medgar Evers. Only a pawn in their game. It's a bit, Bob Dylan sings about the poor black people and the poor white people and how they're just pawns in the games of the top level race baiters and racist politicians or whatever. And Bob Dylan, he's only a pawn in their game. So the people in Elevation or New Spring, yes, they're giving the money, yes, they're financing it, but they're pawns in the game. Have mercy on those marks. But the pastors and the top leadership in these Potter's House type churches, I think those people are fair game, worthy of critique. And you don't need, as a pastor, to kind of make a show of going to, like, befriend them. This is my buddy, you know. Oh, yeah, yeah, I know he's got some problems. But trust me, in the back room, when we're off of Twitter, when we're off of the stage, you know, when it's 3 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon and we have these theological discussions, you know, and I have his ear. There's a lot of partnership where I live here in Bartow County between Southern Baptists and the Pentecostal denominations. And one of the arguments is like, well, now we've got the ear of their leadership. No, we got their tongues in our events. We need to be separate from them. So who are the kings and who are the pawns? Go after it differently. That's my point. When you're thinking polemically, when you're thinking of being critical, when you go after the king, the pawns take notice. It's like beating up someone's dad. If there's a kid And you beat up his dad in front of him and, like, devastate him. Thank God nobody ever beat up my dad in front of me. Because you look up, that's my dad. He can do anything. When you have these adult heroes, when you're a little child, you look up, he can do anything. You don't want to go around beating up little kids. Because if there's a bad little kid, most of the time it's because they're not being parented well. If there's a bad little sheep at the Mega Word of Faith Church, it's because nobody's ever pastored them. They've been hoodwinked. So, for lack of a better metaphor, go beat up their dad. There's a different way to treat the pawns than you would the kings, because you have a greater expectation out of a king than you would a pawn. Thanks for listening to the Christian Commute. This is your host, Seth Dunn. I hope this show, you can listen to this show 3 times if you really like it, get you through the weekend until Monday. And Lord willing, I'll be back with you again on Monday after the old vacation is over. God bless you guys. Now I'm just talking to fill up time because I can't find the button to turn this off. Okay, bye-bye.